Hey, hi. Oh, yeah, Zoom. Great. I'm Jill. I'm an alcoholic. This is mostly for that, right? For no. Okay, great. Everybody can hear me, I assume, right? Great. I'm Jill. I'm an alcoholic. Thank you so much for asking me to be here tonight. I have learned I always say yes to any AA request. This one makes me especially nervous, but I'm here, so I'm sure it'll all be fine. See, it's already in.
Should pick you right up.
Okay, great. I'm not gonna touch it. My sobriety date is May 10th of 2010. I have a sponsor. We talk every Wednesday at 7 a.m. And I have a home group, and I've had the privilege of walking a number of women through these steps. And I am really, really grateful to be not only an alcoholic, but like a sober standing member of Alcoholics Anonymous, which hasn't always been the case in my sobriety, which we'll get to. So there we are. Okay. I grew up in Los Angeles. I'm 43. So I got sober when I was 30. I was an only child, and I had two very nice parents. One is an alcoholic. He's now sober. He's been sober for about 6 years. It's my dad. And my mom is an active practicing Al-Anon, like in recovery. So we've got like a big recovery household now, which is really neat and special. And but growing up in that house, there was just a lot of drinking. There was always a lot of drinking, and they had people over all the time, and I was an only child, and so I was usually kind of hanging out with adults or sort of sent to my room and like hanging out alone. And so I just wanted to like be a part of. I like remember that very distinctly as a kid. I just wanted to like be a part of like the loud chatter and the laughter, and everybody seemed like they were having fun. And I definitely made a connection to like the things that were in the glasses and like the way people were behaving. And my dad drank nightly a lot, as did my mom. And so it was like a thing that I focused on and fixated on. And, you know, as a kid, I would get really excited when my dad would ask me to make his doers on the rocks, which is a little bit of water. And I would like take the big jug and like pour it in, and take like a little sip. I was just fascinated by it. And I can remember thinking as a kid, like, I can't wait till I'm 30, because like I'll be able to drink and somebody will legally have to sleep in the bed with me, and I won't be alone. Like those were my criteria. So I was like uncomfortable and lonely, and alcohol and men were going to fix it. So let me tell you, that's not been the case. So that's that. You know, you hear a lot of people talking about sort of feeling uncomfortable and sort of not getting like the handbook for life. And I relate when people say that. Everybody sort of seemed like they were figuring it out, and I was always like really trying hard to pretend like I had it figured out and just like catch up and just always like tense. But, you know, I don't know if that makes me an alcoholic, but I certainly relate to it. I guess what it means is I desperately needed like some relief, which alcohol certainly provided when I started drinking. My, you know, I usually don't tell the story, but I have so much time. My first drink, like proper drink, I must have been 11 or something, and I was a flower girl or junior maid of honor at a wedding, which meant like when the champagne flutes were going around, like they just put one in my hand. And so I ended up drinking like a couple glasses of champagne that night. And my response was, I was just like racing around the dance floor, like a Tasmanian devil, like screaming some like weird thing, like Happy Mary. I was just like out of my mind. And I was like so happy, and I was so energized, and I was so pissed when my parents made me go to bed and everybody else got to go to the bar, like the cool hotel bar, you know, where everybody was hanging out. I just remember laying in my bed that night being like, ugh, not never again am I going to be left up here. And I like remember like feeling like, I don't know if I felt felt relief that night, but like it certainly like kicked on something, and I was like having a ball. And I was really frustrated that I was like shoved back into a corner. Like I don't know, when I was 12 or 13, I was like the first of my friends to be like, let's sneak a beer, you know, like what do we have? And we had a bunch of beer in the fridge, like the house was just always stocked with everything. And I remember we had Bud Ice and Rolly Rock. And I had heard somewhere that Bud Ice had a higher alcohol content. And so at like 13, I was like, we gotta drink that one. We gotta drink that one. And you know, I like chugged it down, and so did my best friend. And then there was like another one of us. She got scared, called her mom. And like nothing happened that night, but all it did was like, we're gonna keep doing that. Like that was kind of cool. When nobody caught us. I will tell you, when I left for college, I don't know what was that, like 6 years later. When I left for college, my mom had to clean out my room because I think I don't think they thought I was going back, so they like completely redid it. And I was like, cool guys. But they found, I mean, it was just like bottles and bottles and bottles of like beer and like other things like under the bed, shoved in the closet, but I just didn't remember to like, you know, store like storing away as a teenager. So I was always scared somebody was gonna find stuff in like the trash, and like trying to do that whole thing is always complicated. Anyway, so I drank through high school and I really liked it. And I was like, this is my jam, this is what I'm good at. Even as a teenager though, and at parties, I didn't really like people that much. I was not like a partier in the sense of like I wanted to go out and drink and like have a good time. I did that. I mean, if there was alcohol, I was always drinking. And I was usually like blacking out, and I was usually making out with your boyfriend, and I was usually like pissing off my friends. And they were all really frustrated with how I was drinking. And I thought they were just like lame. You know, I had a therapist at the time that was talking to me about my drinking. So I guess I was talking to her about it. So there were like inputs, right? That like something was amiss. And I found that the best drink one could have is the drink they have alone. And so when my parents would go to bed, I would sneak into the kitchen and I would pull from the cupboard like whatever there was. My dad was drinking Bombay Sapphire gin at the time, so it was like a lot of gin and Diet Coke. And I don't know, like tequila and Diet Coke, I mean, whatever was back there, I was like pouring in. And I would just get wasted. I would get wasted. I would sit on their kitchen counter. I would call people because when I'm drunk, all of a sudden, like I feel pretty okay, and I feel like you want to hear from me. If anything, like you really want to hear from me. You know, I have so much to say. I'm really funny. I'm super attractive. So much so that like if nobody answered the phone, I would just go have endless conversations with myself in the mirror. So that would carry through long into my drinking. My best friend was like me in the mirror drunk. And so, you know, I learned at an early age to like hide the hangover because I was like hungover every morning. And that was my drinking. And it kind of like no big deal. But like there was like a thing. People were sort of like paying attention. I went to college and I need to say, like at this point in time, like the obsession, right? Like the obsession's kind of there in the sense of like I like really didn't miss a night when I was like coming into the kitchen. Like I didn't miss an opportunity to like go to a party. I was frustrated when we couldn't get alcohol. But you know, that sort of that desperation, right, that we face sort of later, or at least for me, like wasn't quite there yet. So I just thought it was like a good time, honestly. And I had an example of a father who was a high functioning alcoholic. And I was like, I got this. So like no big deal. My aunt actually was sober. She'd been sober for like 20 years at that point. And I just thought like she couldn't figure it out. And like that was a bummer for her. But so like there's like AA and alcoholism, like it was all sort of there. I went to college and one night I was drinking. Because it was a day and a night, and I got really, really drunk. And I drove home to my dorm as I would normally. I did a lot of drunk driving. And I think I stopped to get like a burrito or a sandwich. And on my way home, I turned a corner, and I almost like hit a biker. And so like I swerved, and I like to this day, like thank God I did not hit that biker. Like some, I mean, honestly, like when I think about my drinking, just like something has always been at work. Because a lot of that could have happened. So I didn't hit the biker, which is great, but my Diet Coke fell. And so I had to pick it up. And so I'm driving, I like lean down to get the Diet Coke, and like I collide into a car that's parked. So it's like, okay. And so I like back up, and like I proceed to, I don't remember a ton of this, but like based on the police report, there were like five cars and they were kind of spaced out. And I somehow hit each of them, sometimes on the outer and sometimes on the interior. I don't quite know how that happened. And I would find out later that my steering rod was completely broken and they could not figure out how I like parked my car. So they came up, I'm like shoving a burrito in my mouth. My roommate has heard the story. She's horrified. I'm like, what's the big deal? And there's a knock at the door, and it's like the campus police. And I was like, I definitely wasn't driving. Like, I think somebody used my car. I'm like, okay. And they're like, can you just put on what you wore tonight? I was like, I don't remember it. I don't think I have those clothes. It was that kind of like negotiation to like come downstairs. And I really thought nobody had seen what was going on. And I came down and they shined a light in my eye, and there was just like in unison chorus, like, that's her. And so like everybody had seen this. And and I tell the story because like this would be the entry point into Alcoholics Anonymous. And it also just demonstrates my complete like lack of care of anything and anybody around me. My plan until the cops came, I was just going to call my grandmother and be like, hey, I got into some trouble. I don't want to tell my dad. I don't really make them upset. And I was convinced she would help me. And I was totally happy to take advantage of her and like just move on. But what happened was like the cops came and got me. Like was not, I was cuffed and then taken to a hot. I don't think I ever got like a proper mugshot or anything, which is kind of a bummer, but did get a DUI. And they dropped me off like very early in the morning, and I was sobering up by then. And I called my parents at like what was probably 5 a.m. their time, which like all parents love calls at that time in the morning. And I think they were just glad to hear like I was alive. And I very quickly explained what had happened, and I was like, wait, I'm an alcoholic, I'm gonna go to AA. And they're like, so great. And so like everyone thought I was just like so brave to like take responsibility at the tender age of 19 to go like deal with my alcoholism. And what that did was like, no, I kind of didn't get in trouble. Like nobody was mad at me. They were really focused on like me getting better. Like I was taking these like really hard steps of like getting sober in college. And yeah, I went there to like avoid lots of trouble. And I think like going to the meetings also helped me with the judge. So there were like a bunch of stuff and I was like checking boxes. But I went to meetings every single day in Tucson, Arizona. That's where I was going to school, in this Alano club, like in a trailer park. And it was, they had two long like buildings, and one was the smoking building and one was the non-smoking building. They usually had the Al-Anon meetings in the smoking, in the non-smoking building, and we were all in the smoking building, and it was amazing, and I loved it. You'd like walk in and like cut the air with like smoke, and it was just like everyone seemed really old to me and really male, and I was like getting a lot of attention, and I was like, this is cool. And it was like a place where I could go and talk about myself, and people would listen. And there was a woman that was very dramatic, right, as to like what had happened. Very dramatic. And I like, oh, sorry, people got like stories around the table, and I'm like, I got a DUI. And this woman, Rebecca, she was my first sponsor. She gave me a book. She like reached out her hand. She started taking me through the steps. And and like despite my like disillusion that I was different than everybody, because like I didn't belong. Like I'm not quite like you. It's nice that you've ended up here. I'm just passing through. Like the thing that happened, like happened, which is like I identified and I related and I felt a little better. And it became hard to ignore that like something that was being talked about in those rooms and in that book was what I understood and felt and had experienced. But I knew I was going to figure it out, so it was all right. And so I left Arizona, came back to LA, and tried to stay sober and was going to meetings, but very quickly, things got in the way. Like, I got a job, I got a boyfriend, I got a new place to live. She wanted to go out, and all of a sudden, right? The puzzle pieces had moved, and I was like, I got this. I was just 19. Like, we don't need to make a big deal about this. And I remember my sponsor at the time, and I was fighting with him, where I just said, I just don't think I'm an alcoholic. I just don't think I'm an alcoholic. And he pointed me to the passage in the book of go out and try some controlled drinking and forget what it says. But I was like, cool, I'm gonna do that. And I remember it went on for 4 days. And for the first day, I think I had two normal pours of wine. And then the next day it was big pours of wine. And then the next day it was two cocktails. And then it was Long Island iced teas. And I was out. I was out for a while. I don't know. I don't know if that's sort of controversial what he did, but he knew I wasn't ready. He certainly didn't put it was a choice. I wanted to drink. I wasn't done. And I wasn't doing the work to keep me here, that's for sure. So I had more learning to do about my condition. So I'm 21 at that time. I got sober when I was 30. And so the next 10 years were kind of a series of I would be out for a year and a half or so, maybe two, and then I'd get sober for about a year and a half, and then I'd go out again. And I did that 4 or 5 times. And my drink, I'm telling you, I was talking to Sven on the way out. It's my drinking's very hard to recall because it wasn't wildly dramatic. I was usually in a blackout and I was usually by myself because most people in my life either thought I was sober or didn't want me drinking or didn't want me in AA. And so, but wanted me not drinking. Anyways, my boyfriend at the time had a weird thing with AA. So I wasn't going to meetings, but I also wasn't supposed to drink, so it's complicated. But so that meant I was living sort of these multiple lives because I would have some friend groups that had only met me maybe that year. And they were like, you seem so normal. I can't believe you ever had an alcohol problem. I was like, and then they would see and then something would happen. But my drinking was often done in secret. And what that looked like was always having something on me, right? And so little airplane bottles or water bottles full of cheap vodka, poured in, Burger King soda cups or whatever. And so I would drink, 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 drink until I had to get to a place. And then I would be okay at the place, but also completely insecure that everybody was is she drunk? And I would watch my words. I was like, did I slur? Can they smell me? And da, da, da. So it was like not enjoyable, but I needed it. And so it's like I couldn't stop doing that, even though it felt awful to do it, but I couldn't show up without drinking. So it was just like this horrible cycle. I was drinking at work. I was drinking in the morning. At the time I was working, I was like an on-air radio person. And so I was on the job drunk. And one day I passed out on the air. I think they thought I was tired. But I was not. I was completely wasted. I actually got lost getting to work that night. I was working a 3 to 6 a.m. shift. So I mean sure, everybody's gonna get confused at that time. But I was blasted and got lost going to work and then it was a disaster at work. But nobody thought nobody noticed it with me. That was the other thing that was always confusing. And so I just kind of slid under the radar. I did a lot of binge drinking in my apartment alone with my cat and my mirror and a lot of sad music. There was nothing that I loved more than drinking a fifth, smoking a pack of cigarettes, and crying with my cat in front of the mirror. That was a really good night for me. And then I'd wake up in the morning and I'd have to look at my phone, who would I have text? Did I have conversations? What kind of cleanup do I need to do? Did I leave the house? Because that was another thing. I would get into such a blackout that I would leave the house. I would drive. I would walk down to the bar. I wouldn't know what happened. And so I would wake up in the morning with this or come to just on the floor. And I would have these like, you'd like shock awake, and you would try to piece the night together, and like that fear and impending doom and sort of the catastrophizing of what happened, like created so much anxiety that like the only thing that I could do, even though I didn't want to drink, I would wake up, I'd be like, I'm just gonna go back to one of those damn meetings. I'm just gonna go back to one of those damn meetings. I'm gonna call my old sponsor. And like between that thought and getting to the phone, it was like, I just need a drink. And like there would be vodka in the fridge or something, or like I'd go down to the liquor store that was like within walking distance, and like my mind would change, and like I was fine, I'll do that tomorrow. Or like it wasn't a big deal. Like, she's not mad at you, that didn't happen, you're being crazy. And my mind would just like rewrite the story, right? That like I would experience like when I wasn't drunk. Even if I was drinking and like people knew I was drinking, I would go to the bar with stuff, and I would go to the bathroom and I would drink what was in there, and then I would go to the bar and like order drinks for people, but I would order like my drink and then like three shots and like quickly like down them and then come back. And again, it was just like all this weird sneaky behavior. Like half the time nobody was even paying attention, but like with all the lies and all the sneaking around, there was also just this like fear that I was just like always going to get caught, or like somebody knew. And so I just always felt like I was being targeted, right? Like you get paranoid. It's like they're talking about you, they know, da da da. And it was an exhausting and chaotic experience. And when I couldn't stop, when I couldn't stop, I, so I told you, I passed out on the air. I went home. I think I drove myself home, and I don't know what happened the rest of that day. But my best friend was staying with me at the time, and I came to in my bed, and like my face was all messed up, and like knees were all messed up, and clothes were not where they were supposed to be. And I looked, because I lived in a loft, and I looked down, and she was like, what happened? And it was scary. It was like one of those moments that felt scary. And so I said I need some help. And I went to my first detox. And I love detox. Sometimes I fantasize about detox now as like a sober adult. Because like I just went into this place. They gave me a lot of drugs. I was just supposed to sleep and smoke cigarettes and talk about myself. And I was like, this is great. So I kind of like reset and got sober again, and was in, and I was going to do it this time, and I had a sponsor, and I was like starting to get really active, and I had service positions, I was going through the steps, and but I still was like, I don't really need to do all the things that you guys need to do, namely helping people. I remember I had gotten through like four and five, and my sponsor elbowed me. At that point in a meeting where you like make yourself available for sponsorship, and elbow me, I was like, I have no interest in helping people. I was like, good luck with that. But like, and that was my attitude. I was like, you guys can do it this way. I'm going to do it my way because like I'm different. I'm different, and this probably isn't forever for me. And I proceeded to, at that time, I didn't like drink right away, but I was starting to take, because I was uncomfortable, right? I have found that like if I am an AA and I am not drinking, or if I'm not drinking and not even AA, like I get uncomfortable, right? I need something to like shift what's happening in here. And at that time, I started to take like boxes of Claritin D. So I was just like taking over-the-counter speed all the time. And then I would talk to people. I would be like, God, my mouth is so dry and I can't sleep. And I like went and saw a doctor. He's like, I'm taking anything different. I was like, no. And it's like why I like went through the whole charade and sort of went to prove it out, like it wasn't a thing. But in that sort of like manic moment, I also decided that I was going to move to Washington, D.C. I had been there before. People drank like I drank. I would be away from all these people that wanted me to be sober and didn't understand that I'm fine. There was a guy out there that didn't know he wanted to be with me, but like if I was just there, then he would figure it out. So like I had the whole plan. And flew to D.C., like my cat, my whole apartment, and just like settled. And and like I screwed people over like in doing that. Like I left my friend who like I was sharing a place with. Like my parents like had to like foot the bill for a lot of it, but I was like, I gotta do this thing now. And so I was just like so selfish and just like never considered anybody around me. I got to DC and like people thought I was sober at the time, so I was like still talking to my sponsor, but I think I was there 4 days before I was just like drinking again. And that was the fall. And by the following October, I would be in rehab. And it was a pretty demoralizing year. I had like a proper job, like going into an office with like a boss and all the things. And I still like couldn't show up without like hitting that liquor store first thing in the morning. They recently closed the Daily Grill over there in sort of DuPont, and it was a little sad because I spent a lot of afternoons drinking in the bathroom of that Daily Grill. I would like go to like one of the many liquor stores and go to the Daily Grill and sit in a stall and have a drink and then go back to work. But so again, it's just like, I mean, who does that? That's not fun. But it's like I needed to do that, and like I felt good. And so I was drinking every day. Blackouts were getting worse. The terror was sort of setting in. The complete unmanageability felt overwhelming. I had now moved in with a friend of mine because like I was so unmanageable, and we thought like me living with her would help. But honestly, it just made me feel like I could take less responsibility, and so I really bottomed out in her house. I called a friend because I was like, I just gotta go back to AA. I just gotta go back to AA. And he dropped me off one night in Georgetown at the West Side Club. And I hadn't been to a meeting in a long time, but I've been to a lot of meetings, so I'm kind of an expert in AA. So I sauntered into this very small meeting that had like six guys, and I was like, is this a men's stag or something? And they're like, no, come in, you can come in. I was like, all right. And I just had this chip on my shoulder, and I don't remember what I shared, but I knew I probably had an attitude, and I probably wasn't all that friendly, and they probably saw right through it. And they afterwards, they're like, "We're going to dinner. Do you want to come?" And I was like, "Ugh, like me." They didn't. It didn't. And we went down to Johnny Rockets, and like I felt comfortable, and I laughed, and it was really nice. And somebody asked me for my number, and I was like, see. And he wanted to give it to the woman that's now my sponsor. And that night was pretty like remarkable in terms of like a big turning point. I did not stay sober. I think I went home that night, and I think I drank. I think that was the night that I like came to, and I like ripped out all of the faucets in like the tile bathroom and the shower curtain. No idea what happened, but I woke up in a wet robe and the bathroom had been destroyed, and it was really scary, and I had a lot of hematomas on me, and I have no clue what happened that night. And I couldn't stop drinking. Couldn't stop drinking. It had gotten to the point where there weren't hours in the day where I wasn't drinking anymore. I would go to work, I was drinking all day at work, I would stay late at work, I would drink. At some point in time, I would black out. I would get back to the place I was li living. I would come to in bed, and I just didn't know. And every day I would wake up and I'm like, today's gonna be different. Today's gonna be different. It's gonna be different. And I would get to my metro stop, and I would hit that liquor store. I remember one of the guys that was in that meeting that night ran into me coming out of that liquor store. And it was really, felt really bad. Felt really bad. And I was just getting so close. And I had started talking to that woman that would be my sponsor. And I think we went to a couple meetings. She invited me to Midtown, which I'm sure you're all familiar with, the DC meeting. And I think I called my doctor that night, and I said to him, I said, I need to stop drinking. I want to stop drinking. I cannot stop drinking, and I don't know what to do. And they like fast tracked me to rehab. And again, if you think detox is great, rehab was amazing. 3 months just like doing nothing. But it like dried me out enough, and I was like determined to be sober. I convinced my family that I could go back to DC. I think they were nervous about how much had happened there, and they wanted like a watchful eye. And I was like, there's this woman. She's amazing. Her name's Elise, and she's sponsoring me. And they're like, all right. And they let me come back, and I started to go to meetings. And that like thing that like always happened, which was like, this is cute. I like what you guys are doing. I'm just gonna kind of do this on the side though. And what this on the side meant was I would go to meetings when I could. I would lie about reasons that I couldn't go to meetings. My sponsor would make suggestions. I would wink at her and talk back to her. And then I would lie about other plans that I was having on the side, which usually were like, I started dating somebody right now, and it was like cheating on him, going out with friends to bars and going to parties. So like I'm lying. And it turns out like if I'm lying and I'm doing like sneaky behavior, like I don't feel too great. And like she could see through it. And so I'm just like uncomfortable all over the place. And there's one more time where I'm going to a party and like I got a drink. And so like downed like a fifth, no, like a pint of something. I went to this party and I made it 10 minutes before passing out on somebody's bed and woke up in like the next morning, like drank my last drop of alcohol, which was like absolute 100. I don't know, it was in a black bottle. I don't know if anybody remembers it. It burned, which light. I went to my home group that night and the guy that I was seeing at the time was like, "What is going on?" And I was wasted, and like he knew that I had like messed up and the whole thing. And I woke up that next morning, and I just felt so terrible. Like I had a bunch of really good people in my life trying to help me. I had like made some friends. I was enjoying my time in AA, and I was hurting people. I didn't want to be doing what I was doing, and there was this like tiny, tiny, tiny moment of willingness. I remember sitting in my bed. It was like hot that day, and I was just like homesick. And my sponsor just asked me. She's like, "Are you ready?" And I said, "I think yes, I'm ready." She said, "Okay, you have to say yes to everything moving forward." I was like, "What?" She's like, "That's the deal. Or I won't sponsor you." I was like, "Okay." And I gotta tell you, like, when I talk to people today about like how I stayed sober and how to stay sober, like my answer is just say yes, because I was saying no a lot. And saying yes, what my life ended up looking like was I was going to meetings every day, like every night. At the time, like women were picking me up, and I was like riding with another alcoholic. It meant that I was picking up service positions at these meetings, so I had like a, I was like connecting in. I had started going through the steps. By the time I got a car, I was driving all over the DMV area, picking up women, dropping them off. And my life just like very quickly just became enveloped by AA just by saying yes. It just had to like, didn't even feel like a surrender, but it was a surrender. If you had told me it was a surrender, I would have been like, absolutely not. Now, did my life have like a lot of prayer going on or like an understanding of a higher power? Absolutely not. It did not. The God thing came way later for me. But I was like going through the motions, and I had gotten in the middle of AA without even knowing it, and I was sober, and I had been sober now, like, for a while, like a couple years passed. And in that time, that guy that I was seeing, became my husband. I was doing pretty good at work. I got this other new job. I had gone through the steps. I had made a lot of really important amends. I had no spiritual connection to anything. And I had a complicated relationship with my sponsor. I can't explain what happened, but I got uncomfortable. I got really uncomfortable, and I didn't tell the truth. The relationship I was in was not good for either of us. He was really active in AA, and so like when that separation happened, it sort of like broke in my head. Nobody told me this. It like broke my connection to like all of our friends and these meetings. I really just used it as an excuse to start to back away. I kind of copped a resentment with my home group and my sponsor, really because I wasn't telling the truth. And so nobody could help me. And so I was sponsorless. I stopped going to meetings and I focused on work. And so I threw myself into my job. And at the time, that made sense to me. I was like, I'm sober. I got this. I'm not drinking. I don't want to drink. And like, this is a good opportunity. So I'm just going to do it. And very quickly, my life got very, very small. At the time, I was doing some area level service for the Virginia area. I was at the PI chair. And I swear that kept me sober just in those, like, in that time. But it was like the one little tether that like had me still. But then when I moved to New York, like it was gone. And while I didn't drink during what I hate to admit is roughly about 5 years, because it all kind of started in 2015. And I really didn't find my way back, with like enthusiasm into 2020. I was a very, very sick, dry alcoholic. And while I maybe didn't pick up a drink, I picked up a lot of other stuff to make me feel better. And what that looked like for me was, at work, really abusing the people that were working like with me and around me. I got into a really terrible unhealthy relationship because I wanted to feel better, and despite how unhealthy it was, I thought it was like filling something. He was a very active alcoholic, and so it was confusing and it was hard. It made me feel really bad. And I felt really bad about myself. And so I spent a lot of money, trying to make my outsides look better. And so I got into a lot of debt. So I'm just like doing damage, like across the board. Family and friends, that aren't hearing from me or when they talk to me are convinced I'm drinking because like the behavior is the same. Like I'm isolating, I'm nasty, I'm short. Whatever light had been like restored in that time when I was like sober and like active had completely dimmed away. And it was a very, very lonely and hard time in my life. And you know, right before I went to rehab, I guess there was a night, I don't remember it, but I called my parents in the middle of the night and I told them I wanted to kill myself. And they were in LA and I was in DC and I like hung up the phone. That was it. And you know, and so like at the, you know, at the sort of the bottom of my drinking, you know, it's like it felt more painful to exist, right, than it did to like wish my life away. And I got to the same place again, like not drinking and not having any solution. You know, they talk a lot about like suicidal ideation. I was just like upset. I don't think I probably was ever going to kill myself, but like it felt better to think about dying than it did to think about living. And I felt like nobody understood. And mostly because I wasn't talking to any alcoholics. My sponsor called me sometime toward the end of like 2019, which wasn't my sponsor at the time, like, but we've been friends the whole time. And I don't know. I mean, like I told you, like I didn't have a like spiritual program, but I didn't not believe. And you know, it's funny, you start to like connect the dots. It's like the dots connect, and I don't know. It's such called the right time. We had an honest conversation, and she didn't push it. She's like, "Okay, I'll talk to you later. You know, maybe reach out to Austin and like Christina, and maybe go to some meeting." And I was like, "I'm good." And then, you know, and she called me the next week, and we talked a little bit. And then maybe the third week, I was about to ask her if she wouldn't mind like temporarily sponsoring me, because I was like, she probably doesn't want to like sponsor me again. And she beat me to it. I was like, oh my God, I was gonna ask you the same thing. And she became my sponsor again that day. And if she had done it any differently, like I probably wouldn't have been ready for it because I still had this fight in me. And we went through the steps again. And a lot of those, like a lot of the same people that were on my fourth step were all on my fourth step again. I added a few, and a lot of the same amends that I had to make were all people I had amends to before. And so like the damage that had happened before and that I had repaired, I just like did it again. So we had gone through the steps, and I still really wasn't going to meetings though. I was in New York at the time, and I found it to be very hard. And when you're not new, but you have time and you're new, you can very easily, if you'd like to, and I wanted to, get lost in AA meetings. I'd come, I'd sit in the back, maybe I'd raise my hand and say I was like new to the meeting. And if somebody didn't come up to me, like literally in half a second, I was like, bye. And so again, I was like, it doesn't work. I was like, I'll just do the steps. But COVID happened. And like the idea that these meetings that I had gotten sober in DC were all of a sudden online, I was like, I'll go to those. Like this whole group that like of meetings and people that I caught this big resentment with, I was like, I just couldn't wait to like see their faces in these little boxes. And obviously COVID was awful if for everybody and like complicated and tough to go through. But like, I mean, it restored me. Like I found AA again. I was going to so many meetings. I was reconnecting with so many people. I didn't even like realize like what not having alcoholics in my sober alcoholics in my life like meant. Like I was so depleted of like people who understood me and like that vital connection that we make, right? And you know, somebody sharing a solution that seems like applicable to my life. It was just, I was like, oh my God, oh my God. It was amazing. And I don't know, I was so grateful. I moved back to Los Angeles at that time and had started in which was kind of a risk because like I had found like when I move around, it's really hard to connect into meetings. But when I moved to LA, everything was still on Zoom. And again, like, oh, what's going on? But you know, I just like randomly picked a few meetings. Like from like, you know, I don't know if you guys remember, like we had these like big Google Sheets. You had no idea like what you were like logging into. And by happenstance, I ended up finding these three amazing meetings. And my network in LA just like exploded and flourished with you know, a bunch of women, you know, with time, some without, with like big networks there and active meetings. And like in the past, when I got so like, you know, when I was saying yes, which was like, again, like the d direction that she gave me, I was just saying yes. It's like I became a GSR again. And like I had service commitments at all my Zoom meetings and I was going every day. And like I was offering people rides when things opened up and they're like, a ride? What? I was like, yeah, I'll give you a ride. You want to meet for coffee? And they're like, what is up with this girl? But I was just so excited. And, you know, and I started sponsoring people again, and I sort of just felt renewed again in a way that I felt like I had sort of lost myself. And but like I will say, the spirituality piece of this has always been really tough for me. You know, and like my part when I think about it is I just was never honest. I was never really honest that I was struggling with understanding the power greater than myself looked like. I wasn't honest that prayer, as it was being described in the book or by my sponsor or by other people, didn't seem to work for me. I wasn't honest that I didn't know how to tap into a connection. You know, I wasn't talking about it. And not only was I not talking about it, I was lying about it. And so, you know, my sponsor would be like, really need you to pray about this. And I was like, yeah. I said this prayer and this prayer and I wrote this down. And I was just like BS. I was just making stuff up, which honestly was kind of the issue that she and I had years ago. Like I thought there was an issue with she and I. The issue was I was lying to her. It didn't feel like big lies, you know, it just felt like she wants to know that I like prayed. I'll tell her I prayed. But it turns out, and it's been pointed out to me, when I'm lying, like I give off this like real weird sneaky vibe. Like people can catch on to it and then they react weird to me. And then I'm like, why are they acting weird? It's this like whole thing. And I'm like, ugh, I don't want to talk to them again. And again, it's this like wall that we create, right? Like I don't let God in, the wall comes up, you know? Misbehave, the wall comes up. I had gotten really interested in six and seven. And I was doing a meeting with some friends because it's like that's what I do now. I just like do other meetings beyond my like 7 a week meetings and like let's do a drop the rock meeting. And I got really interested in sort of the defect piece of this and figuring out how to like how do I take like an action that I'm doing. Like I know I can't just like stop doing it or stop thinking it. Like it's been proven to me that like I'm powerless over a lot of things. And this like turning so stupid. This idea of turning over like really like stuck out to me. And through work in six and seven, I somehow found my way to a higher power. So what was happening for me was I was uncomfortable. I was living in a lot of fear. I was living in like a lot of insecurity, a lot of self-doubt. My head was really nasty to me. I don't know if you guys relate to this, but like my head is vicious, vicious. And I was getting no relief from it. And so this idea of like replacing, right, a defect with like an asset or whatever we want to talk about it, I started to do that with my thought process and asking God, like, what would you tell me if I told you I think I'm worthless? And all of a sudden, like another voice came in and it would be like, remember that thing you did at work today? And like it really was helpful. Or like, I think, and so it's like, it was so profound to me. And when I talk about it, it feels so simple. But inviting like a different conversation in my head was like a breakthrough for me in understanding like having a higher power, and recognizing that it's not only my will that gets me in the way, but it's like my inner dialogue, which is essentially my will, like driving like bad action. So it's like I feel uncomfortable, right? Well, I'm not talking to God, so we're still talking to this part of the brain, which is Jill, and like I feel uncomfortable, so I need to feel better. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to scream at this person at work. That doesn't make me feel better, you know? And so I do the thing. But it's like if I just like ask God, like, whoa, what's going on? This isn't real, right? It's not real. And like, so a lot of my prayer is really conversation, and it's conversation long enough to have a pause, right? Like we just need a pause. I just need a pause. So like stop it. So I like pause long enough to allow something else to enter my mind to then impact the action I take. And like it's like blown my mind. It's blown my mind. And there's like nothing I get more excited about now than like I have a God, I have a higher power. Like we talk all the time. Like I consult about everything. And it's just been this like wild relief from what felt like a prison in my mind. Because I was confused. I was like, I don't know, at this point I was probably 10, no, like 11 or 12 years sober. Like this happened like only in the last year and a half. Sometimes slowly. And I was confused that how can I be sober for this long and still be so goddamn depressed and like still feel so unhappy and still feel like life isn't really worth living. And I would tell myself, well, it's because you took a break for 5 years. You got a lot of catching up to do, you know? And like, I don't, how long, right, am I going to be punished for that? And you know, I say it because it's helpful for me to hear it. Like, I definitely like as I got regrounded in AA, and I was like going to meetings and doing the steps and having a sponsor and sponsoring people. You know, I sought out outside help, which definitely like was important for me. But you know, it was like I shouldn't feel this bad. I shouldn't feel this bad. And in the same way, drinking like brought me to my knees, right? And I had to surrender with that like little like yes, I will do that. I think I had to get to a point with myself like emotionally and spiritually where I had like bottomed out to a point where like I mean I was just driving around the city sobbing all the time. So what is going on? Meanwhile, I'm like going to meetings every day and like you know sharing. I'm like everything's great. And it's just hard to talk about because you don't. How many times have you said something you're depressed? And you know, I anyways, it was a really remarkable experience for me. And And I wish I had opened my mouth earlier, to maybe like talk about like my challenges in sort of the spirituality of this program, but I didn't, and that's not my story. And again, like I am a believer that like I'm exactly where I'm supposed to be in this exact moment, because like it is undeniable that something has been guiding me like day by day, step by step, moment by moment. Like there's too many things that like to chalk it up to coincidence, right? Like when you start to really, really see and like seek too. So I was in LA, and then yeah, I just decided it was important to move again, because like why staying any place for longer than 4 years? And so back to DC I went, and last fall I moved back to DC, and it's been really great. I sort of felt like I Irish goodbye the city in the middle of the night when I moved to New York and didn't talk to anybody and didn't tell anybody I was moving and just disappeared. And it's been really wonderful to connect with old friends and like go to old meetings, both like in AA and then like through work and just like personal life, and kind of have a new beginning here. And I'm an only child. My parents, I feel like when I decided to move, like both their health got weird. So I go back to LA a lot. My favorite thing to do when I'm in LA is go to AA meetings, which again is just like such a just goes to show like my life is not. I was so excited to be sober and I have to go to meetings. Like I was like ready to tell you guys like the good news. Like you can do it without AA. You can. I mean, at least in my experience, you can. And so I've got a really active network in LA. I've got a really active network here. As I mentioned, my dad is sober. We have a complicated relationship still. That is, when I think about sort of all the areas of my life that I've been able to kind of like shore up, correct, move forward with, that one remains the biggest struggle. But I'm very, for a really long time, kind of similar to the God thing, like I would get advice like, you should do this with your dad and you should think this. And I'd be like, absolutely. And I would just like have inventory that was just totally made up of like what I did. Meanwhile, I'd like silently scorn him or like talk back to him or whatever, just like agitate the situation. But I'm trying today, in a much different way. And since I have like this God on my shoulder all the time now, like we chat when we're talking to dad, and it helps. Let's create that pause. But there's still so much more work to do. But I'm very grateful he found AA. I'm very grateful that he's sober. It's really neat to have a family that is like full of program. You didn't get anything from my talk tonight. What I will say is, like the simple response of saying yes, I feel like saved my life. It saved my life, 13 years ago, and it saved my life, 4 years ago. There has been no other solution that works for me besides like a very quiet surrender, like one that I can't even notice I'm doing, just by saying yes, just by reaching my hand out, saying yes to service, saying yes to be helpful to somebody, showing up somewhere, like doing so, whatever it is, like no discussion, like don't argue, just try it. And by the way, like if you try it and you don't like it, you don't have to do it again. But I it's rare that I've ever said yes to something in AA and thought, man, I really wish I hadn't done that. So I am beyond grateful to be sober. I'm beyond grateful to be like in and around like active sobriety and have like a rich community of alcoholics in my life. And it's always a treat to come up here. And see you guys. And thanks so much for letting me share.